Tomorrow morning, then sunny. Highs near 65. Winds from the northwest, 5 to 10, gusting higher. For tomorrow night, lows near 39. And Friday, sunny. Highs near 64 with light north winds.
I believe the system is safe. There are multiple redundancies throughout the system that keep people safe.
After crises at Newark and other airports, what will it take to fix air traffic control?
It is Wednesday, May 21st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, many of Israel's European allies are criticizing the country's latest moves in Gaza.
But U.S. Ambassador Mike Huckabee continues to support Israel's conduct of the war.
I'm outraged that the U.K., Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator.
Also, how a few simple tweaks to brick making could improve air quality in Bangladesh.
Because of the process, a lot of that coal won't even get to the bottom, and so they use quite a bit more than is necessary, which is why they're so heavily polluting.
And at the Cheers pub in Boston, people remember the man who played Norm.
That's ahead. First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. President Trump welcomed South African President Cyril Ramaphosa today, holding an Oval Office meeting that became heated more than once over questions about race relations in South Africa and over an airplane Qatar has gifted the U.S. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben has more.
While the Oval Office meeting began cordially, it grew hostile when Trump repeated false claims of white genocide. At one point, Trump paused the meeting to show the room a 4.5-minute video promoting the idea that white South African farmers are being targeted.
I must tell you, Mr. President, we have had a tremendous number of people, especially since they've seen this. Generally, they're white farmers, and they're fleeing South Africa, and it's a very sad thing to see.
South African President Ramaphosa pushed back against Trump's claims, also stressing that he wanted to, quote, reset the relationship between the United States and South Africa. It wasn't the only topic that angered the president. Trump also repeatedly insulted a reporter from NBC when he asked the president about his administration's accepting a luxury airplane as a gift from Qatar. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The UN says it is continuing to try to get desperately needed aid into Gaza. However, even as some aid is starting to get in, it's not clear how much is getting to those who need it the most. Fears of looting, along with restrictions imposed by the Israeli military, are keeping trucks that have gotten in just inside Gaza. Food security experts, meanwhile, say Gaza is falling into famine unless Israel ends its 3-month-long blockade. Google is making artificial intelligence a more prominent part of its search engine. It is a step to compete with AI chatbots, which analysts think will snag an increasingly large share of the market. Here's NPR's John Rewich.
Google's new feature is called AI Mode, and Chief Executive Officer Sundar Pichai says it's a total reimagining of search. AI Mode appears to operate like other AI chatbots, answering questions, making suggestions, and entertaining follow-up queries. Google has dominated internet search for about a quarter century, but analysts and industry insiders believe that increasingly powerful AI chatbots like ChatGPT and Perplexity pose a threat as more and more people turn to AI for answers. Concerns about AI's incursion into the search arena grew earlier this month when an Apple executive testified in a court case involving Google that traditional Google searches in Apple's Safari browser had fallen for the first time in 2 decades. John Rewich, NPR News.
Electric vehicle maker Tesla and its CEO Elon Musk have been promising that vehicles requiring no human intervention will be on the road soon, though it's a promise Musk has made before. This time, Musk promising thousands of self-driving versions of his electric vehicles will be on the road by the end of next year. Investors are anxiously awaiting a test run of the company's self-driving taxi service in Austin next month. Blame Wall Street's worst sell-off in weeks on bond market jitters. The Dow was down more than 800 points. This is NPR. A college student from Massachusetts is expected to plead guilty to stealing millions of student and teachers' private data from a pair of U.S. education technology companies, then trying to extort the companies. 19-year-old Matthew Lane, a student at Assumption University, is accused of using stolen login credentials to access the computer network of a software and cloud storage company serving school systems. Lane allegedly threatened to release tens of millions of students and teachers' names unless the company agreed to pay ransom of $2.85 million worth of Bitcoin. New data show a record-breaking amount of forest disappearing in 2024. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports fires were the main reason for the loss.
Researchers at the University of Maryland track how much forested area is lost each year in tropical areas around the world. In the past, agriculture has been the main reason that tropical forests are destroyed. But in 2024, fires were the leading cause of forest loss. Fires accounted for almost half of all forest destruction last year. That includes both wildfires and fires used to intentionally clear forested areas. And the total amount of forest loss last year nearly doubled compared to the year before. Forests are important for many reasons. They provide habitats for animals, clean the air, protect drinking water sources, and trap carbon dioxide that would otherwise contribute to global warming. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved lower amid continued global uncertainties, including talks with Iran about its disputed nuclear program. Oil fell 47 cents a barrel, settled at $61.57 a barrel. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is 5:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. We've received support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Coming up this Friday at 6 o'clock, it's the debut of Ham Radio, Cooking with Amy Phelan. You'll also be able to hear it Saturday at 1 o'clock and as a podcast.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Federal regulators are limiting the number of flights in and out of Newark Liberty International Airport. The move comes after a harrowing month for travelers at one of the country's busiest airports, and also for the air traffic controllers who work the airspace around it.
We lost our radar and it's not working correctly. Radar service terminates.
Communications and radar systems went dark several times at the air traffic control facility in Philadelphia, where controllers manage the airspace around Newark. As you can hear in these archived audio recordings from the website liveatc.net.
We don't have a radar, so I don't know where you are.
FedEx 1989, I'm going to hand you off here. Our scopes just went black again.
Three of our radar screens went black and they have no frequencies.
Hundreds of flights in and out of Newark have been canceled or delayed. And now, the Federal Aviation Administration is slowing the pace of arrivals and departures. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy insists that that will help.
I believe the system is safe. There are multiple redundancies throughout the system that keep people safe. The key is not efficiency. The key is safety.
Still, these incidents have raised huge questions about how the mess in Newark got as bad as it did and what it will take to fix an aging air traffic control system. Today, we're going to hear a perspective from inside that system, from an air traffic controller who was working the airspace around Newark during one of those outages. NPR's Joel Rose covers transportation and joins us now. So, Joel, who was this air traffic controller that you spoke with, and what can you tell us about them?
What I can say, first of all, is that they work in the Philadelphia TRACON. That's short for the Terminal Radar Approach Control. These are facilities that handle traffic in highly congested airspace, in this case, around Newark. This controller asked us not to use their name because they are not authorized to speak publicly by their bosses at the FAA, and they're afraid of retaliation for speaking out. They also asked us not to use their voice for the same reason. So what you're going to hear in this story are their words, but they will be read by one of our producers.
Got it. Okay. And as we just said, this person was on duty during one of these outages. What was that like?
They said it was incredibly frustrating to have the tools that they rely on to do the job simply fail. Losing contact with fully loaded jets traveling hundreds of miles an hour in some of the nation's busiest airspace. Again, this is the voice of an NPR producer reading the words of the air traffic controller.
It was like disbelief, and then it was just like fury, honestly. Like, how could they have us working this, you know? Frustration, anger, like just being furious at the FAA because we had other outages prior to that point that demonstrated to us that our equipment was unreliable.
This controller says the FAA is paying a lot of attention to their concerns now, but that was not always the case before. The controller says they had asked the FAA to slow the number of planes using this airspace, but were told no.
Wait, go back a little bit. How did things in Newark airspace get so bad?
I know, this is the big question that a lot of people have. In a sense, Newark is suffering from the same problems as the entire air traffic control system in the U.S. There's underinvestment in technology and systems that are, in many cases, decades old. And there's a shortage of staffing for air traffic controllers. The system nationwide is thousands of controllers short. All of that is true, but according to this controller, the things that happened in Newark are also very specific to Newark. And in particular, the way the FAA moved the air traffic controllers who work the Newark airspace from Long Island, New York, to Philadelphia last year.
So this particular situation was a self-inflicted FAA decision to move us out of New York. We did not have these issues when we were in New York. And so you're trying to make it seem like, well, the FAA is in shambles and that's why Newark is this problem. No, Newark is the problem because you moved us out of New York without a real plan.
Let me back up here for a moment. For years, the FAA had been talking about moving control of the Newark airspace out of Long Island, which handles the other two big airports in the New York area, LaGuardia and JFK. And for a long time, the FAA had trouble hiring enough controllers to staff the facility on Long Island. The training success rate there was also low, and those who did work there made a lot of money in overtime. So the FAA decided the long-term solution here was to move the controllers who handle Newark to Philadelphia, where the cost of living is lower and it would be easier to recruit. Here is Michael Whitaker, the FAA administrator during the Biden administration, explaining the rationale for this back in November.
With this move, we're able to relieve the stress in New York and improve controller staffing levels by recruiting and training controllers in Philadelphia. This has been meant to get us healthy on a staffing level.
As part of this move, some of the controllers from Long Island were forced to relocate. They all get a bonus of $100,000, but many still do not like this because they have families, kids in schools. The controller we spoke to was not happy about the move.
I get it in a sense, like, why? They were like, well, let's move it somewhere else. But I feel like the way they went about it was really haphazard. It was really reckless, honestly. And it was a little bit cruel to us as people, as the controllers who they moved.
There had been 33 certified air traffic controllers working the Newark airspace from Long Island. Two dozen of them made the move last summer to Philadelphia. And according to the controller we spoke to, some of them had big concerns even then about how the move would work from a technical standpoint. Still, the controller says they tried to keep an open mind, but even they were surprised at how badly it has gone.
It's been worse of a disaster than even, like, the most cynical people in the union predicted. It's been a debacle.
The FAA did not respond directly to these allegations, but the agency says it is working on an expedited plan to install new fiber optic lines to replace the copper wires that are still in use in some places, and adding new backup systems to help with the technical issues in Newark. And Sean Duffy, the transportation secretary, says the agency is, quote, supercharging the hiring of new air traffic controllers. But the reality is that it takes years to train them, and there is a nationwide staffing shortage right now. That is especially acute in Philadelphia, where some of these controllers have taken trauma leave to recover from the psychological impact of the recent outages, including the controller we spoke to.
We are at our limit. Our families are telling us you need a break. Like, our friends are telling us you don't seem okay. We're all at that point. Like, you can tell people are breaking down. You can see the misery when people show up to work. There have been grown men crying in the parking lot on their breaks because of our work conditions.
God, it just seems unsustainable. I guess the bottom line is Newark Airport safe?
A lot of people say yes. The FAA just announced that they are temporarily cutting the number of flights in Newark to 56 per hour. That's a number that reflects what the air traffic control system can actually handle. But I put this question to the controller who works the airspace, and here's what they told me.
I had my best friend ask me the other day, like, I got a Newark flight. Is it going to be fine? I was like, no. Don't fly out of Newark. Like, at the very least, you're going to be delayed, but no. Like, I've had to book flights, and Newark is the cheapest option, the most convenient option 9 times out of 10, and I'm not going to do it.
Even the transportation secretary, Sean Duffy, admitted that he had his wife change her flight from Newark to LaGuardia Airport in New York City. Mm-hmm. Not because it was unsafe, he said, but just because she needed to get where she was going. And I think a lot of people will be wrestling with those kinds of choices.
That is NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose. Thank you so much, Joel.
You're welcome.
Last night was a special one at the Cheers Pub in Boston. Locals and out-of-towners shared memories of the hit show from the 1980s and early 90s and one of its most beloved regulars, Norm. George Wendt played Norm on Cheers and died yesterday at the age of 76. WBUR's Sue Von Lee headed to the pub to talk with the folks who gathered to reminisce and celebrate.
And one APA.
Inside this cozy, dark wood-paneled bar, people talk and laugh around the tight space. Framed Red Sox and Cheers memorabilia line the walls. Waiters hustle, balancing burgers and fries, while bartenders pour beer from taps. A mix of 80s tunes fills the room. At the end of a bar is a small memorial dedicated to George Wendt. A single bar stool, a vase of flowers, and a photo of the actor wearing Norm's signature suit and tie. And to top it off, a mug of beer.
Norm was one of the best.
Miles Heger says he started watching the show during the pandemic. He drove to the pub from his home south of Boston about a half hour away when he heard Wendt died. It felt as if the character himself was gone.
I said, one place I gotta be tonight, and that's right at Cheers in Boston, so here I am.
John Snyder was expecting a long line to get in. He orders a light beer, just as Norm, the character, would.
I know he was a beer drinker like I am, major beer drinker. But, yeah, it's sad to hear that he died at such a young age.
Frank Irizarry greets guests at the front entrance. The 24-year-old says he had never seen the show when he started working at the bar 2 years ago.
I would see people run in here and say, Norm, where's Norm's seat at? And I didn't know who Norm was at the time, so it was kind of funny to me.
Irizarry is only on episode 7, but now he's hooked on the character.
I totally get, like, the whole entire, like, idea behind Norm. Like, that dude had a larger-than-life personality, and just his presence on the TV show, like, he made Cheers. Like, Ted Danson's going on, Woody Harrelson, but most people come here when they want to hear about Norm.
Steph Coronella was a huge fan of Cheers growing up. She says Norm was relatable and funny, someone who enjoyed the company of friends at his daily hangout spot.
Norm was just like an everyman. Like, you could just identify with him. He was a little henpecked, but super sweet and so sassy.
Fans remember something special happened every time Norm walked into the bar.
Afternoon, everybody.
Norman?
Hey, what's happening, Norm?
Miles Heger says Norm will be missed.
Many bar regulars from many bars all around the country are going to live on because of Norm.
Norm also had a way of making an exit. George Wendt passed away yesterday, exactly 32 years after the Cheers finale. For NPR News, I'm Sue Von Lee in Boston.
All those nights when you've got no lights, the check is in the mail, and your little angel hung the cat up by its tail, and your third fiancé didn't show. Sometimes you wanna go where everybody knows your name.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 5:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. At 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, Doug Danger, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. We also thank Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. More at timberlakelodgehotel.com. White Earth Tribal and Community College in Manoman hosts Earth Summit 2025, May 28th and 29th. The event strives to incorporate scientific information and Ojibwe traditions to understand environmental challenges. Learn more and register at wetcc.edu. The Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Committee hosts a Veteran Resource Fair tomorrow from noon to 4 at Minnesota North Hibbing Campus. There will be a benefit seminar at 12:30 plus resource providers and a free lunch for veterans. At KAXC, local matters, and we bring you updates on news and events relevant to our communities. We do this because we live here too. Federal funding helps make this kind of local coverage possible. Federal support is at risk right now. You can visit protectmypublicmedia.org to share what KAXC brings to our community. Thanks for listening. Our weather for tonight, cloudy skies, lows in the upper 30s, and tomorrow, areas of frost early, then sunny, highs near 65, winds from the northwest 5 to 10, and lows tomorrow night near 39. For Friday, sunny, highs near 64, and light north winds. More news is next.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank. Part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Gaza, hospitals in the north have shut down in the space of 24 hours. That is because Israel has begun a new ground operation in Gaza in which it says it plans to take territory and hold it. In a moment, we will hear from the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, about the latest offensive and how European allies are responding. First, though, NPR's Aya Batraoui reports on how hospitals in Gaza rapidly collapsed in the face of an offensive that has killed hundreds in the past week and displaced tens of thousands more.
A home has just been struck in northern Gaza's Jabalia. It's Tuesday night, and this video by rescue workers shows them digging with their bare hands and a shovel to reach a family buried in the rubble. A young girl in her pajamas is pulled out, lifeless. But a young boy, bleeding, stunned, covered in dust, is among those carried out, alive. Except there's no hospital for him to be rushed to in northern Gaza. The nearest one is several miles away in Gaza City. That's because in the past 24 hours, hospitals in northern Gaza have been targeted by Israeli shelling and bombardment, forcing them out of service. The head of ambulances in northern Gaza, Faris Afana, says the situation is catastrophic with no medical services in the area, reminding him of Israel's lengthy siege late last year that left the north in ruins and damaged its hospitals, which have now collapsed. The Israeli military says it's targeting Hamas infrastructure in Jabalia and has killed a Hamas fighter accused of taking part in the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. The Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza had dozens of patients until Monday when staff shared this video. It shows fire crews putting out a blaze in the hospital's courtyard Monday night. Health officials say Israeli drones bombed the hospital's generators. Staff and patients fled after the bomb strike because Israeli tanks were advancing. Israel's military hasn't responded to NPR's request for comment on its strikes on hospitals. The attacks on this vital hospital and two smaller ones in northern Gaza this week come as Israel is expanding a new offensive aimed at pushing the population south and forcing Hamas to release hostages. It issued evacuation orders for northern Gaza. Influential Israeli finance minister Bezalel Smotrich told reporters the military is moving civilians out of combat zones. The aim is to move people to southern Gaza, and he says, with God's help, from there to other countries. That, he says, is the goal. Gaza's emergency workers say an estimated 100,000 people are still in the north. But with no hospitals to treat them, it's unclear how much longer they can remain. Aya Batraoui, NPR News Dubai, with reporting by Anas Baba in Gaza City.
Some of Israel's closest allies are harshly criticizing the country. The leaders of Britain, France, and Canada are calling on Israel to end its latest military offensive in Gaza. The European Union is reconsidering its political and economic ties with Israel. U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee says such criticism is misguided.
I'm outraged that the U.K., Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator.
The new ambassador sat down today with NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. And Daniel's with us now. Hi there.
Hi, Ari.
Could you tell whether there is any frustration at all
from the U.S. over Israel's handling of the war right now.
Ambassador Huckabee told me there is absolutely no rift between President Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He said he has spoken to President Trump, to the vice president, to the secretary of state, and has not heard about any frustration with Israel.
What I'm hearing is they're frustrated. They want the hostages out, but they're not blaming the Israelis for it. They're not blaming the prime minister for it. They're blaming Hamas for it, which we all ought to be doing.
How does Huckabee respond to the criticism from European countries?
Yeah, there has been extraordinary criticism from the leaders of the UK, France, and Canada, as you mentioned. They put out this statement about Israel's newest offensive, which began Sunday. Israel has ordered mass evacuations of civilians in Gaza. It's stepped up airstrikes throughout Gaza and killing, according to health officials there, hundreds of Palestinians, including babies and children. And the leaders of those three European countries said, yes, Israel suffered a heinous attack on October 7th, 2023 from Hamas, but they said Israel's current offensive in Gaza is disproportionate. And so I asked Ambassador Huckabee, does the U.S. support this latest offensive?
I think we recognize the sovereignty of Israel. Israel had people murdered in the most vicious, horrible way that we've seen, and I wanted to say since the Holocaust, but in all candor, as awful as the crimes were in the Holocaust, they weren't worse, and in some cases, they weren't as malicious.
Now, the ambassador went on there to describe Hamas atrocities during the October 7th attack. He repeated some unsubstantiated claims about that attack. And I questioned him again about the criticism from European allies about what Israel is doing now.
But these allies are saying that Israel's response today is disproportionate, is intolerable. You've seen the pictures of dead children every day.
Sure.
Do you agree with that assessment?
No, what I agree with is that Hamas could have stopped this on October the 8th, and they didn't. The prolonged suffering for everybody is on Hamas. And I'm outraged that the UK, Canada, France, they're blaming the wrong perpetrator. They need to start putting the pressure on Hamas. Right now, they're willing to give Hamas a victory.
Daniel, as you have reported, Israel did not let any aid into Gaza for more than 2 months. And only now, after intense international pressure, has Netanyahu said that Israel is letting in a, quote, basic quantity of aid. So what did Ambassador Huckabee say about that?
Well, he talked about a plan that the U.S. is backing to get food in. And he criticized the United Nations and aid agencies for not cooperating with that U.S.-backed plan. Now, the United Nations says it's a plan that actually is intended to help Israel force Palestinians into concentrated zones in Gaza. They call it against humanitarian principles.
So broadly speaking, what does Ambassador Huckabee say about U.S. support for Israel's conduct in Gaza right now?
He said Israel is a sovereign nation. It has a right to prosecute the war the way it believes will end the threat posed by Hamas. And the ambassador went back to a comparison to World War II. He said European leaders don't question the Allied bombings on the Nazis, so they should support Israel's campaign now against Hamas.
I just find that so disgustingly hypocritical on the part of some of these European nations that forget their own history, and it wasn't that long ago. And they ought to just go back and maybe take 10th grade civics and refresh themselves.
And so what does it mean, Daniel, for these long allies to now find each other on opposite sides of this conflict, where the U.S. and Israel are more or less isolated, with the rest of the world aligning, saying this is unacceptable?
It really is a new chapter in this war, Ari. This is a significant shift from what we've seen in the past 19 months, these top allies of both the U.S. and Israel coming out in an extraordinary statement calling Israel's actions in Gaza egregious, and furthermore, the European Union taking action against Israel. This is a moment that we haven't seen before in this whole war. And Ambassador Huckabee in Israel did not back down from his support for Israel's actions.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin, who spoke today with U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. You're listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. United Way of 1000 Lakes is looking for volunteers to take part in their Day of Action, Tuesday, June 17th in Cohasset. Find more information at uwlakes.org. Cloudy skies tonight, lows in the upper 30s, but there is a chance of frost early tomorrow morning, then sunny tomorrow, highs near 65.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The Beltrami County Sheriff's Office is requesting public assistance seeking a Kellyer man last seen on April 24th. According to a release, 68-year-old Russell Coyle made arrangements for his dog with family and friends that day. The Sheriff's Office say they believe Coyle could have left town, possibly heading west to find work, but his current whereabouts are unknown, given that he is not known to drive a car, usually relying on family and friends for transportation. Coyle is 5'7", about 200 pounds, with graying red hair and blue eyes. He often wears a beard and carries pliers on his belt. Anyone with information on his whereabouts should contact the Sheriff's Office at 218-333-9111. Bemidji Law Enforcement released the identity of the man found dead in an apartment building Monday. 41-year-old Benjamin Martinez's cause of death has initially been ruled a drug overdose, and the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force intends to continue investigating this as a homicide. First responders were dispatched to the 1300 block of America Avenue on report of a possible gas leak, which was later ruled out. Officers found Martinez's body in an apartment with a woman and child also inside, who were transported to Sanford Health Hospital for treatment. A Carleton County jury found a former officer of the Cloquet Police Department guilty of financially exploiting a vulnerable adult. 37-year-old Lacey Sildred, now of Sartell, will be sentenced at a later date. The Attorney General's Office prosecuted the case after a referral from the Carleton County Attorney's Office, and the case was investigated by the AG's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Sildred met 78-year-old Joan Arney, a woman suffering from dementia, in May 2020. After a series of welfare checks, Sildred was appointed Arney's emergency guardian after a court hearing. She then presented herself to Arnie's bank and gained access to the victim's bank account. Arnie died that October, and Sildred, despite having only known the victim for 5 months, attempted to inherit the entire $150,000 estate through a probate petition. The Medicaid fraud investigator assigned to the case determined Sildred used, quote, undue influence, coercion, and other enticements to establish a fiduciary relationship with Joan Arnie, including being appointed as her guardian. Firefighters' efforts paid off Tuesday as lines around the wildfires near Brimson held despite strong winds and low humidity. Megan Buffington has the update.
Containment around both fires also increased as of a Wednesday morning update from the incident management team. The Camp House fire remained steady in size and is 73% contained. The Jenkins Creek fire grew about 50 acres and is 13% contained. Evacuation orders for much of the Camp House fire were raised Wednesday, though those areas remain in set status, meaning residents should be prepared to evacuate again if needed. As property owners return, officials say to be mindful of fire and utility crews and the potential for falling trees. Some smoke inside the fire scar should be expected, but smoke or flames outside the burned area or near hazardous areas should be reported. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
5 missing search kits have been distributed by the Department of Public Safety's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office. These kits are intended to ensure that searches for missing persons, especially on tribal reservations, wouldn't be delayed by a lack of proper equipment or logistical planning resources. Indigenous persons are overrepresented in missing persons cases. According to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Indigenous women make up less than 1% of the state's population, but account for 10% of all reported missing females. Search kits are now located in Red Lake Nation, Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and the Lower Sioux Indian Community. One additional kit is located at the MMIR office in St. Paul and is available by request. MnDOT will host an open house at the Itasca State Park Visitors Center Thursday for an informational meeting about planned construction on Highway 200. Beginning July 8th, crews will resurface Highway 200 from Clearwater County Road 2 to Highway 71 near Itasca State Park. Through traffic will be detoured onto Hubbard County Roads 3 and 9, as well as Clearwater County Roads 2, 40, and 37. The north and east entrances of the park will remain open throughout construction, which is expected to end in late August. The meeting at the Visitor's Center will be from 4 to 6 p.m. with no formal presentation planned. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Wall Street is having a rocky week. Another one. The Dow fell almost 2% today while investors are selling off bonds from the U.S. government. Now, those bonds form the backbone of the global financial system. But now investors are so worried that they are making what is known as the Sell America trade. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen is here in the studio to tell us about it. Hi, Maria.
Hey. Hey there.
Okay, so it's only Wednesday and sounds like it's already been a week on Wall Street.
Another week, another really wild ride on Wall Street. And stocks are down so far, but the real story is that people are selling off bonds. That has sent yields on long-term U.S. government debt to jump above 5% this week, which is really unusual. And it's especially unusual at a time when the stock market has already been so volatile.
Why?
Well, bonds are supposed to be the safe and stable part of the financial system. But now we're seeing all these warnings that everything is not so safe and stable anymore. I mean, just today, the European Central Bank warned that President Trump's tariffs are putting the global financial system at risk. So obviously, tariffs continue to hang over everything. But this week, the main headline has really become the U.S. national deficit, which is running close to $2 trillion.
Although that piece isn't new, right? The deficit has been huge and getting huger for a while now. Why is it an issue suddenly?
Well, it's all come to a head because of two things. First, President Trump and his party are trying to pass a budget bill that would include tax cuts. Tax cuts means less revenue coming in, and that will make it even harder for the government to reduce the deficit. And then on Friday, Moody's downgraded the United States. It specifically cited the rise in the national deficit, and it said that it doesn't expect the Republicans' budget proposals to create what it called material reductions in that $2 trillion. Uh-huh. Mary Louise, this wasn't a shocker. The other big ratings agencies had downgraded the U.S. years ago, but the timing, as the White House and House Republicans are trying to pass this bill, that sounded a lot of alarms. So all of this is leading investors back to what is known as that Sell America trade.
Yeah, so stay there. What is the Sell America trade? It does not sound good.
No, I mean, bluntly, investors are worried that the United States is in trouble. And so they're selling things that are tied to its economy. I talked to Winnie Caesar, who's the global head of strategy at CreditSights, and this is how she put it.
The whole change in narrative around U.S. economic exceptionalism and just a general perception that the U.S. is perhaps a riskier place to park your cash than it was 6 months ago.
And this all does come back to these tariffs. They've made consumers, businesses, investors, and now other governments warn that actually maybe the United States is too risky to invest in anymore.
Maria, let me take this from the markets level to just the personal level. How is all of this going to play in our day-to-day lives?
Well, the bond market is the basis for everything that we borrow, so credit cards, car loans, mortgages. And bond yields are basically the interest rates that the government pays on its debt. So when those yields go up, it makes everything else more expensive. And meanwhile, bonds are also supposed to be the stable part of your retirement savings or your other investment accounts. But with all the stock market chaos we've seen and the ongoing warnings about tariffs increasing prices, now bonds are also in flux and loan prices are likely to go up. And so ultimately, in other words, there's just no safe haven.
NPR's Maria Aspen, great to see you.
Great to see you.
The Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has attempted to embed itself in another agency. This time, it's the Government Accountability Office. The office has refused, but as NPR's Chris Arnold reports, many experts say rather than try to elbow its way in the door, DOGE should have been asking GAO for help all along.
For months, DOGE has been strong-arming its way into government agencies, gaining access to sensitive data, and helping to fire workers. Doing that at the Government Accountability Office, that would be way over the line, says David Walker. He used to run the GAO.
The DOGE team needs to read the Constitution again. There are three separate and equal branches of government.
GAO operates under the legislative branch, in other words, Congress, not the White House.
DOGE has zero authority to review GAO's operations.
Walker's been nominated to positions by both Republican and Democratic presidents, and he says GAO and DOGE supposedly have a very similar mission, to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. Except, he says, that GAO's been doing that for decades, has a staff of several thousand people, and it's really good at it.
GAO is like a long-standing professional football team, and DOGE has some very bright people, but it's more like a much smaller pickup football team from MIT. It's like intramurals, okay?
Over the past 15 years, GAO says its recommendations have resulted in $725 billion in savings and revenue increases. It just came up with an updated list of proposals. It says that could save another $100 billion or more. Just one example, it's been studying a space-based laser communication system that the Defense Department's designing. GAO says it's found a tweak to the program that could save hundreds of millions of dollars. The White House didn't respond to NPR's request for comment, but has defended DOGE for finding waste, fraud, and abuse. And the current head of the GAO recently said that DOGE lately has been engaging more with GAO about some of its recommendations. Still, David Walker says poor planning and inadequate coordination with Congress have hamstrung DOGE.
DOGE way overpromised on savings, originally promising $2 trillion. They now claim that they've saved about $170 billion, but in reality, I think the real savings is maybe one-tenth to one-fifth of what they claim, because only Congress can cut spending.
Walker says so far, DOGE has mostly been targeting programs that the Trump administration just doesn't like and indiscriminately firing people. Linda Bilmes is a government efficiency expert at the Harvard Kennedy School. She says that DOGE could have learned a lot from GAO.
One of the real tragedies of the whole DOGE effort is that they just ignored this kind of expertise and they didn't tap into the knowledge base of the people already working in government.
She says the chance to work alongside Elon Musk to help reform government lured in a lot of very talented young people. Some of them were students of hers at Harvard.
I know firsthand some of the individuals who worked for Elon Musk, but they were not leveraged in terms of their own talents. They were put in charge of a website that they had no idea what it was and asked to fire people, and they really were put into positions in which they were entirely unsuited for.
Meanwhile, as far as DOGE trying to embed itself in GAO, there's another thorny issue there. GAO currently has dozens of investigations underway into whether the Trump administration improperly froze funding that was already allocated by Congress. David Walker again.
There clearly is a conflict of interest there. DOGE shouldn't be anywhere close to looking at what GAO is doing in connection with those activities.
The current head of GAO recently told Congress that the Trump administration was not immediately responsive to its investigations. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In the U.S., the bulk of cut flowers you find in shops are imported. So tariffs imposed by the Trump administration could cause local florists to look for homegrown alternatives. But meeting that demand could be challenging, as St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson reports.
Walking up the gravel road through the iron gates of Queen Bee Bloom's flower farm, you're instantly hit with the intoxicating smell of fresh flowers.
I can smell it already.
Okay, I'm going to make you put on glasses the way I see things. We're going to stop right here. How's that sound?
That's the Queen Bee herself, Elizabeth Victor, who goes by her nickname, Luli. Her 164-acre Spanish Lake floral paradise in St. Louis County is filled with all sorts of goodies, like viburnum, lilac, and cherry blossoms. Victor does not rely on imported bulbs or other products to keep her farm up and running. She planned to expand, but her hopes for a grant from the USDA evaporated in February.
I mean, I had a couple hours of just elation. And then the next morning, the news was that all the funding was being clawed back.
Flower farmers like Victor, who do not rely on imports, could stand to benefit from the Trump administration's across-the-board universal tariffs as imported cut flowers become increasingly expensive. Roughly 80% of cut flowers sold in the U.S., including heavy hitters like roses and tulips, are imported from places like Ecuador, the Netherlands, and Colombia. Farmers say the best thing people can do is take advantage of the flowers that are native to and seasonally available in the U.S. and not subject to tariffs. But Victor says meeting the demand from local florists will be a challenge.
You can't have it both ways. You can't try to drive business back to this country while not helping us be ready for it.
Mima Davis is co-owner of Urban Buds. It's an urban flower farm in St. Louis. Davis has been in the flower farming game for 30 years.
It's kind of a wait and see kind of moment, which is maddening for the flower farmer because everything we do is a year in advance.
Right now, she and her crew are trying to navigate a new level of uncertainty. Her farm relies on imported bulbs and tubers. And thinking about what the tariffs will mean long term weighs on her.
It would mean cutting back, becoming smaller. I'm already a small farm. How small can I be?
The tariffs and USDA cuts affecting small farms and florists are heightening a decades-long problem dating back to the 90s. The U.S. promoted flower growing across South America as an economic incentive during the war on drugs. Tariffs were eliminated from cut flowers, and flower farming in Ecuador and Colombia exploded. Mom-and-pop glass greenhouses in the U.S. couldn't compete and closed their doors. In fact, the greenhouse that Urban Buds co-owner Davis later bought was one of them. Southern Illinois florist Amari Bourgeois is the owner of New Moon Bloom Co., a small black-owned business. She says the latest round of tariffs are a hard pill to swallow.
We do already have contracts and things planned out for our future, so I think initially it was a little bit of worry, like, what am I going to do in this situation? How is that going to affect us?
But because she gets some of her stash from local grower Urban Buds, she's one step ahead. As the Trump administration's back and forth on tariffs continues, people who work in the floral industry remain hopeful that there's a solution on the horizon that will benefit small farms, florists, and consumers. For NPR News, I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson in St. Louis.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. Thank you for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, it is As It Happens, News from a Canadian Perspective. And at 7, Doug Danger, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Cloudy skies tonight, lows in the upper 30s. There is a chance of frost early tomorrow morning. Sunny skies with highs near 65. Winds from the northwest, 5 to 10. Lows tomorrow night near 39. For Friday, sunny, highs in the mid-60s and light north winds. Support for KAXE comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Central Lakes College Performing Arts Center in Brainerd presents the documentary play, The Exonerated, May 22nd through the 24th. It is based on the true stories of six individuals who were wrongly convicted of crimes. Find tickets and showtimes at clcperformingarts.com. You can let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Belthalia Creative Arts Space presents a Taste of the Arts tour this Saturday and Sunday throughout the Bemidji, Popaski, and Turtle River areas. Visit several locations and see art installations, demonstrations, and celebrate culinary artists with a focus on fermented foods. More information on Belthalia's Facebook page. There is more ahead from All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Bangladesh consistently ranks among the countries with the worst air quality in the world. And yes, there are a lot of cars in its capital city, Dhaka, but the thing that makes the air smoky and black and unhealthy actually has a lot to do with the brick-making industry, which burns large amounts of coal. A new study shows a few simple tweaks to how those bricks are made could have a huge impact on the air quality in Bangladesh and other countries in South Asia. NPR's Jonathan Lambert has more.
If you fly over Bangladesh's capital, the first thing you might notice is the haze. Look closer and you'll see dozens of smokestacks pumping out thick, dark plumes of smoke. Those are brick kilns, which produce nearly 30 billion bricks each year across the country. All that smoke comes from all the coal they have to burn to harden those bricks. Samir Mattil is an energy systems engineer and consultant in India.
It is essentially a lot of black smoke impacting the workers and the nearby villagers, and also impacting overall air quality of the region.
Some studies suggest that smoke is responsible for up to 50% of the pollution that hangs like a dense fog over Dhaka in winter. The kilns produce so much pollution because they're pretty inefficient and burn way more coal than they need to. But Mattil and his colleagues have figured out some ways around this. They realized a big problem was how clay bricks, more than 800,000 of them, are packed inside the kilns for each firing. Here's Nina Brooks, a global health researcher at Boston University.
The columns are really, really dense, so you can see almost no space in between the columns.
And then workers start shoveling coal in to get the kiln hot. But the tight spacing chokes off the oxygen needed to fire the bricks. It also blocks coal from reaching bricks at the bottom.
Because of how they're stacked and because of the process, a lot of that coal won't even get to the bottom, and so they use quite a bit more than is necessary, which is why they're so heavily polluting.
But kilns don't have to be configured this way. Mattil, the engineer, has spent years working with kiln owners in India to make them more efficient. He's found lots of ways to make a difference, but the biggest one is simply leaving more space between bricks.
The better you are able to provide air and there is better fuel and air mixing, then the possibility of black smoke will be less.
To find out just how much less black smoke could be produced, Mattil, Brooks, and their colleagues did a massive experiment. They trained some kiln owners and their workers on several simple changes, including how to stack the bricks to allow more air to flow. Another group of kilns got no training. All told, they studied 276 kilns.
So that was a big logistic challenge to train thousands of people, both classroom and practical.
But the training paid off. Fuel use dropped by about 23% for kilns that tweaked their process. The researchers estimate that drop in fuel translates to about 20% less carbon dioxide and air pollution, too. That benefits workers and people living near the kilns. The study appears in the journal Science.
The results were a little bit beyond my expectations.
Overall, the results also impressed William Checkley, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University who wasn't involved in the study.
This is wonderful evidence of how simple, low-cost interventions can have a big impact.
Realizing that impact could be challenging and would require training thousands and thousands more kiln owners and workers across Bangladesh. But the research team is already working with government officials, and if successful, these small tweaks could go a long way towards cleaning up the country's air. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Jonathan Groff has won all kinds of attention for his Broadway roles, from King George and Hamilton to his Tony-winning turn in Merrily We Roll Along. In his new musical, Just in Time, he portrays pop star Bobby Darin.
There's something really sacred and special and in the moment about what happens in live theater that feels in line with what Bobby's magic was and why it makes sense to me that we've forgotten about him a little bit, because his magic was in that live performance.
Groff has been nominated for another Tony for his role. On Wildcard, he talked with Rachel Martin about his early career and the influence of Broadway star Gavin Creel, who died of cancer last year.
What weight did you have to shoulder before you were ready?
The obvious one that's coming to my head is like when I came out of the closet. Through sort of like moving to New York and experiencing other people that were who they were and watching them thrive, and then falling in love with Gavin Creel, who just passed last year, and going, oh, wow, this is way better than anything. And so that was like the final like kick in the ass that I needed to like, boom, fully express it and talk about it and release that weight. And the acceptance of that is now, it helps me with every other version of that in my life.
I assumed that someone who had so much success so young, that the answer would have dovetailed into something about, you know, the weight of fame. But I hear you saying that maybe you were able to manage those things because there was this fundamental weight.
Yeah.
That you had to experience the releasing of that, and maybe that helped with all the other burdens in your young professional life.
It's interesting. There's something related to it, though, like what you're talking about with fame, because part of why I wasn't coming out was at that time in 2006, coming out was like limiting your career as an actor.
Yeah.
And what happened when I was with Gavin and I came out was I decided to not care anymore about that. What I was feeling with him and how he was living his life was so inspirational and such a like beacon of what could be possible, that the idea of being famous or being in movies or being on television, suddenly that those ambitions became so much smaller when I felt love.
Wow. I'm so sorry about Gavin, by the way.
Huge, huge loss, but it's such a privilege to be able to talk about him, and he was one of a kind.
And what a gift he gave you in that.
Oh my God, beyond.
In that relationship, yeah.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Then you can see Jonathan Groff in Just in Time on Broadway now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at MacFound, www.ecofuels.org.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can also find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Sustaining memberships start at $5 per month. Thank you so much for your support. Ahead, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. There is a frost advisory in effect.